Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tongue Tied, Untangling Communication in Sex, Kink, and Relationships by Stella Harris. Narrated by Reagan West. Introduction. In my years as a sex educator and coach, the number one question and concern I hear, even when the people asking don't realize it. From not knowing how to bring up vulnerable topics, to not having the language for the things they want to try, to fearing that talking at all will ruin the mood. I hear these things so much that all of my classes, regardless of topic, include segments on communication, and it's a big part of all my private coaching sessions, too. Interested in bondage? You've got to talk about it. Want to open your relationship? So much talking. Eager to try new kinds of sex? You guessed it. That requires a conversation. Despite how vital communication is to our sexual health and well-being, most people have no idea how to talk about sex or even bodies. The combination of a lack of factual information combined with a shroud of shame leaves many people paralyzed. I got a stark lesson in just how uninformed people are about bodies when I was only 13 years old. My sex-positive mother, who raised me with shame-free and factual information about sex and bodies, passed away, and I moved in with my paternal grandparents. The shame-free information came to a screeching halt. When I got my period, it was no surprise because thankfully I'd been prepared for that by my mother. So I hopped on my bike, rode to the local drugstore, and got some tampons. Sometime later, my grandmother saw the tampons and had a fit. While some of her argument had a moralistic tone that I wasn't ready to refute at that age, her argument also had factual inaccuracies that I was ready to point out. She told me that using tampons would break my hymen. So I used the tools that were available to me in the pre-internet age, and I pulled out the encyclopedia, turned to the section with layered transparency pages that showed genital anatomy, and I taught my grandmother about hymens. That experience left a mark on me, and I've never shaken what it feels like to be shamed for natural things that bodies do, or what it's like to have to confront inaccurate information with your own hard-won knowledge. These days, talking and writing about sex and bodies is my full-time job. I've gotten to a point where it's not just easy, it's second nature. But there's no chance I'll forget how scary it is for most people. I hear that every day from my students and clients. It's a guarantee that every time I teach a class, someone will ask, "But won't talking ruin the mood?" My heart breaks for all the people suffering through mediocre sex in silence. Doesn't bad sex ruin the mood all on its own? Whether it's an oops in a kink scene or a sexual encounter gone sideways, I find it hard to believe mustering the courage for a conversation would be worse. Sometimes I explain this. Sometimes I demonstrate dirty talk. Maybe it's because I'm a language nerd, but talking about what we're going to do is one of my biggest turn-ons. When a partner whispers that he's been thinking how good it feels to have his fingers inside me, my pulse quickens. When a partner tells me she can't wait to try out a new toy on me, I tingle just thinking about it. Not only is anticipating what's going to happen part of the fun, but if I don't want that, or I want something else, I have time to say so. People come to my office and tell me things they've never said out loud before. They tell me their desires, their fetishes, and their fears. They tell me what they'd love to try. And again, I tell them they have to talk to their partner. And I give them the tools to do so. If you're uncomfortable talking about the kinds of touch you like or discussing safer sex needs, what happens if you need to talk about an unexpected pregnancy or a positive STI result? Getting used to talking and having clear and open communication can be a lifesaver when big issues come up, because you already have a framework for having conversations, even difficult or uncomfortable ones. And while I know people find talking scary, I've seen the breakthroughs my clients have made. I've seen people report back from one coaching session to the next that everything has changed, gotten easier, because they have the words they need now. When I teach at conventions, sex shops, and sex-positive venues, my communication class is a mainstay. That class includes some of the exercises you'll read about in this book. My favorite thing when I'm working with students or clients is when their eyes go wide with the aha moment that they really can have the sex life of their dreams. It's my hope that with this book, you can as well. Stella Harris, Portland, Oregon. How to use this book. I suspect you'll use this book, like most books of its kind, in two ways. You'll skip through, or go start to finish now, and then later you'll use it as a reference when you're addressing a particular issue or new relationship. I'm a big book nerd, both personally and professionally, and my home and office are filled with books. I'm not sure I have a single book-free surface, and although I have sticky tabs marking my favorite passages, whenever I pick up a beloved reference, I find something new. Maybe the first time I read the book, I wasn't dealing with jealousy, but now every word in that section leaps off the page like it was written just for me. That tends to be the way of these things. Some tools don't speak to you until you need them. The other difference could be whether you read this alone or with a partner. Again, either is fine. Some of the exercises call for self-reflection, and others can be done with a partner in or out of the bedroom. With many exercises, you could be doing it as a book club for two or more, where you work through chapters and examples intentionally. But many of the items can also be brought up casually with no reference to the book. You'll have to get a feel for what style works for you. In my classes, I always tell students that now they have me as an excuse. If they need an icebreaker with their partner to try something new, or to bring up a touchy subject, they can say, "So, I was in this class." Because sometimes knowing how to start the conversation is the hardest part. That's probably one of the reasons you're reading this book. So feel free to use it as your excuse, from mentioning what you're reading to leaving it on the coffee table. This book is a tool, and I encourage you to use it in any or all of the ways that make sense for you and your situation. Underlying philosophies. This book is written based on some core philosophies. It assumes that we're all responsible for ourselves and the way we behave in relationships, and also for our own well-being and needs. Ultimately, we're all responsible for getting our own needs met, from having sex to having orgasms to getting to try that new restaurant that just opened. Would we like our partners to be involved in some or all of those things? Sure, but it's still our responsibility to ask rather than expect them to read our mind. And if your partner doesn't want to go to that restaurant, that's when you decide if you want to go alone or with another partner or with a friend, or maybe to decide that it wasn't a need but a want and one you can do without. The same is true for sex. You can't get what you want if you don't ask for it. So this book will give you ideas of things to ask for as well as ways to do the asking. But it's always possible the other person will be unable or unwilling to do what you've asked. So then it's up to you to figure out how to take care of yourself in that situation. And we'll talk about that too. about what to do when you hear no. Some notes on language. You'll read the word partner in this book a lot. It's already appeared in this chapter several times. When I use the word partner, I mean whoever is in front of you in that moment. It can mean a hookup you'll spend an hour with, and it could mean someone you've committed to spending your life with. It's referring to whomever you're having sex, kink, and conversations with. The word negotiation will also come up in every chapter. For some people, the term brings up frightful memories of asking for a raise or buying a house. For others, they think of a lose-lose compromise. When I say negotiation, I mean a very particular kind of communication used to reach agreements around sex and kink. In sex and kink negotiation, everyone's needs, desires, and limits are taken into account. And the only activities that we'll be engaged in are the ones everyone feels good about. Kink refers to a whole range of activities, from spanking to bondage to more advanced fetishes. The term is very versatile and tends to stand in for any activity, usually sexual, that's considered unconventional or outside the mainstream. I also use the word play liberally. It's commonly used in both kink and sex-positive communities to describe the activities two or more people are going to engage in. Play could be a threesome, or it could be a spanking. It's a way of defining the set period of time when these activities are being engaged in. This book also strives to be as gender-neutral and sexuality-neutral as possible. Unlike some popular books on relationships, I don't believe the genders are all that different. Yes, the way people are socialized is hugely influenced by our presentations. But I don't think treating your partner like an alien or like an animal to be tamed is a healthy or productive stance to take. A study at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science, led by Lise Elliott, has found that the hippocampus is the same size in both men and women. The team's discovery came from a meta-analysis of more than 6,000 structural MRI scans, which showed that there was no significant difference in hippocampal size between men and women. The discovery also counters many popular explanations of the differences between men and women. Sex differences in the brain are irresistible to those looking to explain stereotypic differences between men and women, said Elliott, and they often make a big splash. But as we explore multiple data sets and are able to coalesce very large samples of males and females, we find these differences often disappear or are trivial. From a Wired article by Emily Reynolds. The problems of socialization in a sex-negative society are why this book also talks about figuring out and owning your own shit. Have you been socialized as a caretaker? I certainly have. That's something you need to learn about yourself so you can figure out how to balance those impulses with your own self-care. Not to mention avoid stifling another person by providing care they haven't asked for and don't want. Have you been socialized to believe your needs come first, or that doing the dishes is never your responsibility? That's something to look at, too. You can negotiate any kind of relationship you want to have. Maybe you fetishize 1950s households, and playing those roles is part of your dynamic. That's fine with me, as long as everything that means to you has been explicitly stated and agreed upon by everyone involved. Because where we get in trouble is when we make assumptions, and many of those assumptions are drilled into us from day one, often based on our perceived genders. So do the homework of turning those assumptions on their heads, or at least interrogating them, so you can keep what's useful to you and discard the rest. Perhaps the only guarantee I can make is that figuring out and owning all of your biases and assumptions will improve your communication and your relationships. Some writing and advice on relationships would have you waiting for your other half. As much as I love the Aristophanes myth, I don't buy the story, and I think it's harmful. We're all whole and fully realized people on our own, and maintaining our own identities and our own independence is essential for showing up in a healthy way to our relationships. Whether well-meaning or not, sometimes people use tools meant to help with communication or relationships as a way to manipulate others. The way it usually goes is that someone points to the tools or philosophies in the book to tell someone else they're doing it wrong, or to bring all communication to a halt until it's spoken in the form the book suggests, like the buzzer going off in Jeopardy if you don't answer in the form of a question. Using the tools in this way utterly misses the point. It's turning them into weapons, and that isn't fair to their creators or to your partners. So use the tools in this book and others to improve your communication skills, not to control the behavior of others. I hope you'll find some of the tools and exercises in this book helpful, but keep in mind that you can choose what's useful to you and leave the rest. 1. What are we aiming for? Healthy relationships and good communication. The best measure of the health of any relationship is the quality of the communication in it. Every single thing that we can't or won't talk about, openly and without fear or shame, is a crack in the relationship's foundation. Franklin Vo and Eve Rickert, More Than Two. We all want to feel heard and understood. With partners, with friends, with coworkers, communication is essential to human interaction. But just because we've all been practicing it since we uttered our first words doesn't mean we've learned how to communicate effectively, especially when it comes to a romantic or sexual relationship. Good communication is essential. Most people would agree with that, but when you dig down into details and applications, it gets a little trickier. So, what does good communication in a relationship mean? It means when you speak, you feel heard. It means each person in the relationship has empathy for their partner, and everyone has both their own and the other person or people's well-being in mind. It means feeling safe, bringing up your feelings, fears, wants, and desires, knowing that when you speak up, you won't be criticized, judged, or shamed, that you have a safe space to share what's going on with you, and that you'll truly be listened to and understood. Talking, confiding, sharing, it all builds trust. Think about your earliest friendships, when you were a kid. Sharing secrets was one of the biggest signs of close friendship. We'd whisper or pass notes, and these confidences were shared with only our closest friends. Hopefully, our communication styles have grown a bit since those days, but the essentials are the same. We feel the closest to the people we feel most comfortable sharing with. And to be fair, maybe some of it hasn't changed that much, where once we pass notes in the halls, now we might exchange text messages. Instead of whispering to someone under the covers with flashlights lighting your face, we have post-sex pillow talk. But one thing remains the same. These are the ways we experience intimacy. Think about how you felt the first time someone leaned over and whispered, "Can I tell you a secret?" Do you remember the rush of excitement? The feeling you got because someone trusted you that much? And not only that, but how eager you were to hear what they were going to tell you. Our secrets may have changed, but we can recapture those feelings in our adult lives too. That exchange of vulnerability, giving another person the chance to reject or accept us, and thrilling when the new information we've shared brings us closer. You can play with sharing secrets as a way to build intimacy with the section coming up. Sharing our secrets or any vulnerable information means handing another person a way to hurt us. And when they don't use the information against us, that brings us closer. So when we're learning to talk to our partners, we also need to learn how to listen. We need to figure out how to hear what's being said fully before we let our minds start racing with how that information affects us. We need to listen without planning how we're going to respond. And we need to listen with kindness and empathy. It's the only way to build strong and lasting relationships. Read on for ways to practice not only communicating your needs, but valuable listening skills too. Relationship boundaries. The idea of choice in relationships is key in any relationship structure. Monogamy is considered automatic and the normal way of being in a relationship. But I believe all relationships would benefit from actively choosing to be with one another within whatever relationship structure works for those particular partners. Rena McDaniel, Practical Audacity. Whether you choose to be monogamous or in some variety of open relationship, it's important to discuss the specifics of what that means to you. Many hurt feelings and sometimes even breakups happen because a relationship boundary was crossed that one party didn't even know existed. Like with sex, we consider what we think about relationships to be obvious, and so we don't always voice our assumptions about what being in a relationship means. Sometimes, we haven't even been explicit about being in a relationship. Say you've been hanging out with someone for a while. You go on dates. You have sex. Maybe you've even met some of each other's friends. These things often progress organically, such that a "let's talk about us" conversation never happens. In this scenario, it would be easy for one person to think that was a capital R relationship, while the other person has another word for what they're doing, or maybe no word at all. Say the person who thinks it's a relationship also thinks that relationships are always sexually exclusive, while the other person either doesn't think this is a relationship, or even if it is, they are used to open relationships. They might have sex with someone else, truly believing there's no reason not to. But when the person they've been spending time with finds out, they could be crushed. Things like this can happen without anyone acting maliciously. But even without cruel intentions, feelings can get hurt. This is why it's always best to be absolutely explicit about any expectations you might have. If you've reached a point with someone where you expect them to be monogamous, that needs to be explicitly communicated. Not only that, but you need to define what monogamy means to you. You might be rolling your eyes at me right now, saying, "Surely this one is obvious to everyone." Not so fast. What about going out for drinks with a coworker of the gender you're attracted to? Just the two of you. What about a quick kiss on the lips as a greeting with a close friend or with a former partner? What about talking about your sex life with friends or with strangers on the internet? What about watching porn, reading erotica, or masturbating? Each of these are examples I've heard that led to fights because one person thought the activity was clearly innocuous, while the other thought it was a breach of their monogamy. And these are just a handful of examples. I'm sure you can think of a lot more, and in fact, I encourage you to. As an exercise, sit down and think about what being in a relationship means to you. What do you consider fidelity or loyalty? What emotional or sexual boundaries do you expect to maintain in a partnership? Also, it can be helpful to think about which of those are absolutes that you need in place for your own well-being and which could be negotiable. Sometimes, you won't know this until it comes up, but it's useful to know where there's room for healthy compromise. Here are a few things you can think about. Flirting, hugging, kissing, cuddling, holding hands, seeing someone naked in person. Strip club, sex club, etc. seeing people naked online, webcams, etc., exchanging pictures online or by text, sharing fantasies or dirty talk online, seeing certain TV shows or movies with someone else, going to special restaurants, parks, or other significant locations, having a crush on someone else, falling in love with someone else, sleeping in the same bed with someone else, platonically, sex with someone else when out of town, going to sexy or kinky parties. Once you've gone through these ideas and added your own, compare lists with your partner, and make sure to drill down to specifics as much as possible. You can't think of everything that might come up, but having an open dialogue about these issues is really helpful. Make sure this doesn't become about policing someone's behavior, but instead, talking about each of your comfort levels with the different activities. Crossed boundaries. No matter how much talking you do, there's always a chance that a boundary will be crossed at some point. If that happens, have a conversation about why it happened. Was the boundary unclear or unknown? Was someone acting out because they don't think the boundary is fair? Only by figuring out why it happened can you address the real problem. If an apology needs to be made, read on to learn how to apologize effectively. Healthy boundaries versus control. Talk of boundaries can get complicated fast, especially in open relationship circles. There are a lot of differing ideas about how to express boundaries in a relationship. Some people who practice open relationships are very couple-centric or hierarchical. For these folks, it's very common to have explicit rules about what can and can't happen with other people, sometimes with a great degree of detail. For other people, like relationship anarchists, these boundaries sound like coercion or unhealthy levels of control, and are considered unfair both to the partner and to the additional people that person might engage with. The minutiae of these distinctions are beyond the scope of this book, but it is valuable to take a look at some of the broader issues around establishing boundaries, so you can make an informed decision when you're considering your own boundaries. Before you establish any boundaries, think about why you want them and how they'll affect your relationship. We often set rules, and call them boundaries, to help manage our own fears or insecurities. In these cases, it can be helpful to work on our own feelings and responses rather than trying to control our surroundings and relationships. Because ultimately, not everything can be controlled, and we'll have to confront those feelings eventually. Boundaries are about taking care of ourselves. Every time you feel uncomfortable or upset, it's a chance to learn something about yourself and perhaps to learn about a boundary you need to set. If you're dating someone who likes to be spontaneous and make last-minute plans, and you're someone who likes to know your whole week's schedule in advance, that can be a problem. Perhaps this person says to you, "Maybe we can get together on Friday?" And you agree and put Friday in your calendar. Then Friday rolls around and you don't hear from them. You text, only to find out that they ended up going on a weekend trip. They thought the plans were tentative. You didn't. If this upsets you, you might need to set a boundary about scheduling. Maybe you tell people you're involved with that you plan a week in advance, and if they want to see you, they need to plan in advance too. That won't work for some people, and that's okay. We always have to filter for folks who are a good fit for us. Doesn't mean the spontaneous person or the schedule-oriented person is wrong. They just might not be right for each other. But maybe scheduling a date night is no big deal for the spontaneous partner, and they're happy to do it in order to see you. Then that person knows what you need, and that clarity can set people at ease. And you can feel calm about your schedule rather than resentful as you wait by your phone for them to call. Saying what kind of notice you need for scheduling a date is ultimately about you. But things tip over into being controlling when you're making rules about what a partner can do or how they can use their time. If instead of saying you needed notice for dates, you said,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?